Welcome to the Your Brain Uncovered podcast, where we discuss science and science-based tools for everyday life. I'm Aya Tarabin. I'm a translational neuroscientist and a researcher at University College London. Also want to emphasize that this podcast is part of my desire to promote open science communication to the general public, so it is quite separate from my other roles. Now, in today's episode, we're being joined by Marcus Glennon. He's a researcher at University College London who is currently focusing on looking at the neuroplasticity-inducing effects of psychedelic drugs. Welcome to the Your Brain Uncovered podcast, where it is my job to interview pioneering scientists and authors to tease out some of their most fascinating work. We discuss neuroscience and psychology tools for everyday living. I'm Aya Tarabin. I'm a translational neuroscience student at University College London. I also want to emphasize that this podcast is my personal goal of bringing zero cost to consumer information to the general public, so it is quite separate from my other roles. Now, this episode is the fourth episode of this show's career series, so after listening to it, we hope you'll come out with a better understanding of our guest's unique career path. Hopefully, they'll be able to provide you with an overview and an understanding of what their position really entails, why they do what they do, and how to follow their footsteps, you know, if that really beats your drum. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Mr. Marcus Glennon. Marcus is a PhD candidate at University College London who is investigating the neuroplasticity-inducing effects of psychedelic drugs. Without further ado, it's a pleasure to have you here, Marcus.
Thank you for the invite. Glad to be here.
Really happy to have you here. And can you please tell us a little about your background and how is that you became interested in the work you're currently doing?
Sure. So my background is primarily in psychology and neuroscience. I've always been interested in the brain and mind, like many of us have. Studied psychology and neuroscience at university. And it was just the magic of the brain that attracted me to it. It drew me to doing that undergraduate degree. Just how can something as complex and abstract as consciousness arise from a collection of cell tissue and water and electricity? It really drew me towards it. And in my undergrad, I always intended to pursue further research. I just knew it had to be in a subfield I was extremely interested in. And then I came across this recent psychedelic neuroimaging work that had been done. I was blown away. I found it really bold and exciting. And just the thought of adding layers of complexity in the form of psychedelics onto an already extremely complicated thing, i.e. the brain, really excited me. It's attempting to measure and capture things that are just impossible to measure and capture. These immensely powerful subjective experiences and finding ways to scientifically approach the unexplainable, whilst also shedding light on foundational brain function and exploring potential medical avenues. I think this field has a lot to offer. So that's sort of what drew me to it in the first place.
Okay, wow. That sounds amazing. Your why has been obviously well thought through. What we'd really like to know is, we've touched on your research involving psychedelics. Psychedelic substances have been a really hot topic of debate in the last couple of years, and we just want to know how is it that you're exactly introducing this into your work. So how are they involved?
As I'm sure you've seen in recent literature, psychedelics are demonstrating quite strong therapeutic potential in the right context. Mm-hmm. And one of the proposed mechanisms of how they are showing this is through their plasticity inducing effects. What we're doing in our research is figuring out whether there is any evidence for these plasticity inducing effects. That's sort of the role they're playing in our research.
Previously, I believe you've demonstrated the safety and efficacy of ketamine and for alcoholism and the therapeutic effects of MDMA, I believe. And now you're on to DMT. We would really like to know how is your approach to, looking at DMT different from previous substances and drugs? Is it the same or is it different?
On one hand, it's the same. Mm-hmm. On another, it's quite different. So the ketamine study you mentioned, yes, that was a success. We successfully used ketamine to facilitate an intervention used to treat addiction. Mm-hmm. We'll be using that same intervention, but this time hopefully facilitating it with DMT instead of ketamine. So in that sense, it matches very closely what we've done before, and we're assessing it in a very similar way. However, this time we'll be collaborating with another research group, mm-hmm. Jeremy Skipper's language lab. They do a lot of great neuroimaging research. And so now we have a large neuroimaging component to our DMT research, and it will hopefully shed light on the plasticity-inducing effects of these drugs at a neurological level, as well as a psychological and memory level. So we'll be able to get a more holistic view of the plasticity-inducing effects of these drugs.
Okay, that's amazing. If we were, would you be able to provide us with maybe a real-life example where, or maybe a study of relevance that has shown that the memory-enhancing effects of psychedelic substances in a way? Because I'm not really familiar with this literature, and neither are some of my listeners. So would you be able to give us some context?
Sure, yeah. So I can go into the our proposed intervention that we'll be using.
Amazing. Okay.
So our study is mainly about the mechanism of these drugs and what they do. Mm-hmm. We are also probing the feasibility and efficacy of psychedelic-assisted clinical intervention, that is memory reconsolidation. So in short, the logic of that is this. So phobias and trauma-related disorders, addiction disorders, and some others are not inherent. People are not born with them. Mm. They may have particular genetic predispositions to these disorders, but they aren't born with them. Okay. Ultimately, they are learned behaviors. And if they're learned, they can be unlearned under the right conditions. So we know that memories and associations can change. We've all experienced that. But the question is that something we can harness clinically? So for the past couple of decades, two or three decades, many studies have been done on this. And it appears that when we reactivate a particular memory trace or association, it enters an unstable state and has to go a restabilization process, which is called reconsolidation. Whilst memories are in this unstable state, we can target this process and change the memory. We can strengthen it, we can weaken it, or we can just generally interfere with it. So an example of how these studies have been done in the context of spider phobia, reactivation can be as simple as showing an individual a spider, and then after this, prescribing a drug that interferes with protein synthesis, thereby blocking memory reconsolidation. And then the subsequent effect of that is a weakened fear response to spiders. It's quite amazing. It actually works. They really do show promise. Regarding how this procedure will look in our own study, we'll be doing a similar thing, but in the context of addiction. So the cues we show participants will be images of alcohol, be it beer or wine or something else. We'll then administer the psychedelic drug DMT, a drug thought to significantly enhance plasticity in the brain, therefore potentially enabling us to change these maladaptive addiction-sustaining memories. A couple of very recent studies have been done showing that psychedelic compounds have successfully interfered with memory reconsolidation. But yeah, like I said, these studies were in rodents. Ours will be the first, to the best of my knowledge, to be done in humans. It's quite a bold study. It will be the first psychedelic memory reconsolidation study done in humans, but the rationale is there, and it could work.
Okay, wow. That is amazing. I guess the question kind of begs itself is, why do you choose DMT? Why not NDMA or psilocybin mushrooms, for example? There's a lot of literature out there looking at that. So why did you choose DMT specifically?
That's a good question. So I think some people do suggest that the efficacy of MDMA in PTSD is memory reconsolidation based. So that would be a very interesting one to look at. Mm. A big part of the reason why we're using DMT is the length of time it lasts. So its effect when injected will be about 15 minutes. That means feasibly it makes a lot more sense to use than psilocybin, which can last up to 8 hours. There is a particular window for this memory reconsolidation to take place. Mm. It's believed to be anywhere between 10 minutes and 6 hours. A psilocybin trip can last about 8. It makes sense for us to use DMT because of the amount of time it lasts. Also, arguably, it's a more pure tryptamine, a more core psychedelic. Nah, scrap that, that's not very good. But yeah, the time component is an important one.
Okay, got that. And don't worry, I'm going to add quite a valid and interesting reason why you've chosen DMT. It seems like you've really thought that through. What about, there's a lot of controversy in terms of its neurotoxic effects. There has been some literature stating that it can destroy serotonergic neurons in a way. Some papers came out that argued that's the case, and then others came out to rebut it in Science magazine. What are your thoughts on that?
From what I've seen, the physiological effects of psychedelic drugs are very minimal. I think they're physiologically extremely safe. Mm-hmm. I think a big review a year or two ago by David Nutt showed that they really are quite remarkably safe compounds. And there was a lot of fear-mongering in the 70s about the dangerous effects of these drugs, particularly their effects on DNA. But that was just, they are unfounded claims. There's little evidence for their toxicity, as far as I'm concerned. And there is more evidence, although it's not conclusive, there is more evidence for their plasticity-inducing effects at a neural level. But there is, you're right, we need to be careful with it, and there is a great many more studies that need to be done on this matter.
Okay. Your current project, right? So you're using imaging? Right, so imaging studies to practically examine the interconnectedness and activity of brain areas when DMT is given, right? When it's administered. So what have you been able to observe so far?
So currently, we are still, data collection hasn't fully commenced mm-hmm. in our project yet. We're still in the piloting stage. But there have already been some quite significant points from piloting that have already opened so many new avenues to go down, which we probably won't have time to go down. But so many interesting points have arisen, even just from three pilots. The most major example of this, from my perspective, are the memory effects. Mm-hmm. So one of our participants stated that he found the drug to be quite amnestic, so leading to memory loss. And that statement in itself reveals a whole world of questions. So does DMT have an amnestic effect? Or is it simply a matter of it inducing such a rich psychological experience that it was impossible to remember anything? So does it interfere with memory directly? Or is it a matter of information overload? And what effects do these drugs have on memory encoding and consolidation? And can they affect memory retrieval? Some people report enhanced retrieval of personal memories whilst under these drugs, under the effects of these drugs. Others report false memory generation. So what determines which of those they experience, and how does this link to dose? And what about different types of psychedelic? This is just one of the many understudied areas in this field. Some incredible work has been done on it already, but there's just so much more to be done. I think for me, that's the biggest thing that's arisen already, just a very small statement about the effects of these drugs on memory. The worlds of research that unlocks.
That's amazing. But do you think maybe those two different responses were dose dependent, or were the people that have practically given you those two different reactions to this administration, did they get the same concentrations? Was it the same dose of DMT?
Sorry, to be clear, when I was referring to the enhanced personal memory recall or false memory generation, they are just anecdotal reports. Outside of my our study. That's just from reading online what I've read.
So it's not, it hasn't been specified exactly.
Not exactly, no. Okay. So this, yeah, but it's a huge question. Is it dose dependent? Is it drug dependent? Is it context dependent? There are so many effects to look at.
Wow. Based on, you know, all of what's out there and what you're currently doing, where do you envision the future, you know, future work on psychedelic drugs going?
There's the whole consciousness component, mm-hmm. I suppose. So psychedelic drugs have profound effects on consciousness. And that is one of the ways we've been able to probe brain function in the past by either if you disrupt a process in the brain and see what the psychological impacts are, you can make links between the brain and the mind. And the same applies for psychedelics. So you can see psychedelics as being a disruptor of consciousness or an enhancer of consciousness, whatever you want to call it. And you can end up linking brain function to these highly advanced abstract changes in consciousness. I think that's an enormous field of psychedelic neuroscience that could shed some really interesting light on how consciousness looks in the brain. There's also the medical component, of course. These drugs have been proposed for all sorts of medical conditions, and they appear to have quite broad therapeutic effects. There are so many questions to answer in that. Do they work for all conditions, and what does it depend on? What should the support look like? What should the psychotherapy look like? So many different avenues to go down. This field has it all. One of the biggest challenges is a logistical one, to be honest. So all research can be messy, and neuroimaging studies in particular can be very messy, and so can drug-related studies. So if you combine all that together and you get a large-scale drug-related neuroimaging study, you end up with a study that is very difficult to organize, and there are so many different moving parts. We need scanning operators, clinical psychologists, medics, experimenters, participants. It's a lot, and it's quite hard to overcome. We're currently in the process of, you know, putting a system in place, but it's really quite difficult. In terms of a bit more of an interesting challenge, I think simplicity versus complexity is quite a hard debate. So like I've said a few times, this whole area of psychedelic research is incredibly new and exciting. So much is yet to be done. So much is interesting. It can be hard to know what to narrow down on. And before you know it, you've got this huge selection of measures and questionnaires that will basically be a full-time job for participants to complete. So me and my team have struggled with narrowing down what we want to do, what we want to focus on, because there are an infinite number of avenues we could go down. And you've really got to factor in what's actually feasible in a limited time frame and with limited funds, of course.
Wow. Okay. Well, it seems like you're putting in all the work. Slowly but surely you're going to get there. Who do you feel, you know, most responsible for with the work you're doing?
Who do I feel most responsible for? What do you mean?
Well, in a sense, you've devoted a big chunk of your, you know, youthful years to a PhD focused on investigating the effects of psychedelic drugs on memory. I'm pretty sure there's an internal motive to that, right? It's more than just, oh, I'm interested in this, but is there someone or something that, you know, wakes you up every morning and gets you going?
It's a very good question. I've never been asked that before. I don't think there's a particular group of people I wish to help. I hope that doesn't sound bad. It's just, I think the world in general, this is knowledge that the world should absolutely have. For the sake of patients and also for the sake of the general population. You know, this research is about understanding ourselves and helping patients and also helping just the general public. There's a harm reduction component to this research. The better we understand these drugs, the more able we are to protect the general population from the potentially adverse effects of them. So I think that the groups of people who will be helped by this research are numerous.
That's quite true. And I love the honesty as well. You did not give me a TED talk. You seem to just be doing it for everyone and anyone, and for the joy and love of science at the same time. It's not right.
Well, thank you. Yes, it's a nice way to put it.
That's beautiful. And this is a question that you can feel free not to answer. You know, we all have blind spots, right? What stigmas do you think influence your perception on a day-to-day basis when it comes to your work? Is there any room for improvement?
One thing springs to mind. It's a blind spot that I see others in this field have. Mm-hmm. I try to stay away from it myself. I don't think I'm, I don't think I subscribe to it myself. But I think people have all sorts of motives to get into research. In particular, psychedelic research. I think some people really like psychedelics, and that's fine. And I think some people can be a bit prejudiced about someone's work based on who they are and why they got into the field, which is a shame. We should be assessing work on the quality of the work as opposed to the individual and why they got into a field. I think that's one to remain aware of, particularly in this sphere of research.
Have you ever heard of the Black Swan bias?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, so the Black Swan bias is it's like a confirmation bias, right? It's like the tendency for us to ignore the evidence that contradicts our beliefs or assumptions. That's something quite common in research, and that's something that really affected me for quite some time. And it's only when I started asking my guests this question that I came to realize that, because someone once asked me back that question. But you seem to have way smaller problems to worry about. So, yeah.
Well, either that or I'm just blind to them. I don't know.
No, you're good to go. You know, you're quite accomplished. I mean, because you live with yourself, you seem to take it for granted, but you are, you really are. You know, you're in the field of psychedelic research. You're doing a PhD for UCL. You've done great for yourself. I and my listeners would love to know, what advice would you give to, you know, a young student that is looking to get into research and start getting involved? What is one piece of advice you would give them?
Oh, thank you, first of all. That's very nice. Research in general or psychedelic research?
Well, whatever suits you. You can, yeah.
Cool. Piece of advice. I think my main advice is just to get as much experience as possible in as broad areas as you can, as possible, in as many areas as you can. That's what seems to make the most valuable researchers, whilst also showing you that it's something you really want, because some people go through this whole path and realize it's something they're not cut out for. So I think get as much experience as possible, get as much research experience as possible, because it makes you incredibly valuable and it helps you figure out what you want to do.
Okay, wow. So yeah, go out there and start with those internships, huh?
Exactly.
Well, that's good. That's a great piece of advice. You know, most of us are kind of always our biggest hurdle is the fear of not being good enough, right? But in reality, what really underpins it is the fear of being actually good enough and having to do the work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. For all you listeners out there, I provided relevant links to publications and Mark's own practically LinkedIn, if you want to reach out to him, and a link to his own group as well.
Sorry, it's Marcus.
Marcus. Okay. I'm so glad you told me. I once had the Dimitris, a professor, and I called him Dimitri, and it was so embarrassing. God. But we move on. I'll repeat that.